good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this latest lunchtime session with DPP, brought to you this week in partnership with Reed. I'm joined, as ever, by David Holmes. Afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Ollie, and welcome to everybody who's joining us this afternoon.
Absolutely. So the session this afternoon, we're going to be talking about retention a little bit, kicking around some of those ideas. Obviously, we do like to record these sessions, as some of you may know. There should be a privacy notice on screen either now or there has been. Mars, if you could flash that up again for anyone who's missed it. Just that we like to put these out afterwards in the form of a podcast. Obviously, any issues at all with that, just let us know. So, as I said, we'll be talking about retention. We'll do a little bit as well about what's been in the news, what we've been working on this week, just anything of interest. As ever, these sessions are not ours, they're yours. So please do not hesitate to get involved at all. Comments, questions, concerns, anything at all you want to kick around, do just either pop them in the chat and I'll try and keep an eye on them, or unmute, dive in. It's what these sessions are for. So to get the ball rolling this week, Dave, anything that you've seen in the news of interest that you wanted to talk about?
Just a couple of things loosely. I'm sure we're all aware of it. We've seen it. The story about Matt Hancock with the CCTV and being caught in the news. And I think it was it yesterday or the day before it was reported that it was reported in the papers at least that the Information Commissioner's Office has raided a couple of properties and taken possession of some computers and bits and pieces as a consequence of that. I've not read the full story. I don't know if anybody else has kind of jumped into any deeper than that. But that was one of the things I'd noticed happening in the world of data protection in the last week.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was when that story broke, and I think we all saw the images, whether that's a good thing or not, I'm not entirely sure. But I saw a lot of connections in the privacy world sort of saying, well, hang on a second, how on earth has this been allowed to happen? So that's bound to be interesting.
Sorry, I was just going to jump on that one, just in relation to the CCTV. Yes, there's an issue of how did it happen, and it was alleged, at least, CCTV from within a government building, so people are now kind of looking at that and kind of scraping, or at least kind of going through the measures. I think there was another MP recently had his office swept for bugs to make sure his office is clean and bits and pieces. But it just showed there's a human element to all of this as well, because at the end of the day, whether you agree with what Matt Hancock did or whether you disagree with Matt Hancock did or whether you like or you dislike him, there's still families involved. Both of them still had families, both of them still had kids and things like this, and there's families falling apart as a result of it. So it just goes to show, whether you agree or whether you disagree, there's still a human element in addition to the data protection side of things.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on that. And Peter saying the ICO is investigating the CCTV provider. It's been announced this morning for a breach. So apparently that's where they reckon it's come from. So interesting to see what comes of that. I've also seen a lot of chatter this week, both in the sort of privacy world and more broadly in the media, about something which has sort of been rumbling away and evolving, I think, increasingly, which is this sort of business whereby quote-unquote hackers are scraping mountains of personal data off of social media platforms or networking platforms, compiling databases and then selling those on. I think we've talked about this a couple of times over the past couple of months. So obviously there was the Facebook incident, which was absolutely everywhere recently, which they tried to downplay as an old incident, although we know from certain reports that was entirely part of their strategy. In fact, they're trying to sort of make it out as it being an industry issue rather than an organization specific one in relation to themselves, which is interesting. And then the more recent one this week, I think, is LinkedIn have sort of been more targeted. It's an interesting issue because obviously you sort of get these conversations around, well, is it actually a personal data breach within the meaning of the law? There's most likely a security vulnerability there, but you know, I don't claim to be an expert on these things, but there's certainly a lot of considerations around this. And I think broadly there's a topic of, well, actually, you know, I think there's an increased awareness of the amount of personal data that we have out in a public space, more and more so. You know, we're aware that if we post things on Facebook or on LinkedIn, it's going to be in a public sphere. But you know, back in the day, that wasn't always necessarily the case. I know that when I first sort of got on the internet and started posting. I wasn't necessarily as aware as I should have been at that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think some of it possibly hinges a little bit on kind of ethics, doesn't it? Because you put the information, say like you used the LinkedIn example there, you put your profile onto LinkedIn, you're sharing some information, maybe more or less than what other people are sharing, but it's your platform, you're trying to interact with your peers, you're trying to tell people about the work that you're doing and the experiences and the knowledge that you've got. You're not necessarily doing, well, I'm assuming this is within the privacy policy on LinkedIn, but you're not necessarily wanting or deciding to put your information onto LinkedIn for an unassociated organization to basically scrape that data and monetize it for their own purposes. So you could say, yes, it's in the public image, it's the public arena and things like that, but it's I think it comes down to the ethics side of things and whether does it actually feel right? There may be a is it legal, is it not legal kind of thing, but even if it was deemed legal, does it actually feel right that somebody's scraping profiles that you've put on there, not necessarily for marketing or targeting purposes, and scraping that and monetizing it?
Yeah, it's interesting that, and it ties into something I've been working on this week, which is I've been working with one of our charity clients on a potential effectively wealth screening project for their fundraising activities, which is something that we've looked at in the past for other charity clients, which is it's an interesting area to say the least, because in effect you're taking a relatively similar approach. You're trying to, you know, scrape as much information as you can about high net worth individuals from publicly accessible sources. So, you know, at what point do we draw the line on that sort of thing? I don't know. I don't necessarily have the answer, but I think it's an interesting one to think about anyway.
No, for sure. And I think it was a few years ago, and I'm just trying to rack my brains how long ago it was, because it's prior to me working with DPP. So it must be maybe near on 5 years now, maybe. And it's all, and there was about 11 charities all fined. It was 11 or 13 charities fined. Following the Olive Cook incident. And Olive Cook was if for anybody who remembers, was the 89-year-old puppy seller who it was alleged through the Daily Mail that was hounded to death by charities selling data, targeting old people and the vulnerable people. So selling data amongst themselves and also wealth screening and bits and pieces. And they were all looked at by the ICO, or at least 11 charities were looked at by the ICO that found things like wealth screening wasn't mentioned, and they weren't being fair or lawful or transparent with their activities, because they didn't explicitly say that they were wealth screening or give you the option to opt out of that type of profiling. Instead, they used kind of terms with rather ambiguous meanings and bits and pieces to kind of say, well, we want to say we're wealth screening, we just don't want to tell you that we're wealth screening because it doesn't sound very good. And I think 11 charities were fined between £18,000 a piece, I think it was.
Yeah, something to that effect. Rob raises an interesting question. So he says, it's something I've seen this week. He's asking about the privacy implications of potential petitions to make ID verification necessary to be able to operate social media accounts. And I've seen this in the context of, so obviously we've seen the, frankly, absurd and extreme frustrating, very disappointing and disgusting abuse that some of the England football players have suffered off the back of their Euro 2020 final penalty misses. And I think that's where some of this conversation has come up, in that people are able to hide behind profiles online and spew abuse. So do we introduce measures to force people to verify their identity to have and operate these social media accounts? It's something which I have seen, Rob. I'll be honest, I've not given enough thought to it to properly formulate an opinion. I'm not sure. There's a part of me which instinctively says it seems excessive, but obviously in the context of something so heinous, your intrinsic reaction to say, well, yeah, do everything you can. In all honesty, I don't know. I've not weighed it up properly yet.
Yeah, I would probably follow that. I absolutely agree. I think the everything that followed the Euros and the consequence of the Euros, I think, is not justifiable at all. And I think it's not got a place in society. I think it's right to have a focus on the area. In order to do that, is this kind of a relevant approach? Well, it might be. Very similarly, I've not really kind of thought it through. I've not kind of looked at the arguments in there. But one thing that it would do if each individual had to approve their ID for their social media accounts would possibly stop a lot of spam accounts generating rubbish and making it look like there's a lot more negative comments because it's being produced through a spam bot as opposed to individuals. It's not taking away the seriousness of it. It's not trying to water down the seriousness of it. It's still completely unwarranted and completely unacceptable behaviour. But by individuals being linked directly to accounts, it may, I'm not saying it would stop, but it may possibly stop kind of spam bots generating as well.
Yeah, quite right. Quite right. Sorry, Philippa, I saw you did have your hand up then. I don't know if you want to jump in with anything.
It was just, hello, I'm Philippa Kane from Guide Dogs, and it was just to give some clarity on the charity issue. And I'm very conscious I'm going to sound defensive, but we were one of the charities involved. And it wasn't actually Olive Cook, it was a gentleman called Samuel Ray that the Daily Mail got very excited about. Olive Cook's family were very clear that they didn't want her name involved in it. And the wealth screening was, it was an issue, but it was an issue based on Elizabeth Denham's personal feelings. And we're still having, as a charity sector, that conversation with her. But it was mainly about the selling and buying of data.
For sure, and thank you for the clarification there. Mr. Ray did follow Olive Cook, so I do apologise for not mentioning that. But it was all kind of wrapped up within that episode, so it's
they wrapped it up in the media. I mean,
they did, yeah, they did.
Son was paid by the Daily Mail to go forward as being, you know, and he was the one that took the campaign forward because he was told, the ICO said they wouldn't take action unless someone made a complaint. So the ICO, the Daily Mail paid him, I think it was about £4,000, to take the action.
For sure. So thanks for the clarity then. You're absolutely right again with Olive Cook. Her family was quite clear that it really wasn't the charities.
Yeah. Yeah.
So thank you for clarifying those points.
Absolutely. I've seen Steph put in a controversial question in terms of what's the difference between a hacker and a company with an opaque privacy policy, both forms of social engineering. It's very, very astute. We mentioned a couple of weeks ago a lot of these sorts of dark arts, potentially, which are performed by certain companies in terms of misleading or at least opaque privacy information and misleading consent opt-ins, which are always difficult. It's certainly a good question. I have to say that it's one of my number one bugbears is either unintentionally or potentially intentionally, opaque privacy policies. It really does get to me. They have to be made transparent and accessible. So it is an issue. Just keeping an eye on the chat in terms of age verification, some interesting points raised by Rick and Mark. We might have to save that for another time, though. It's certainly a very interesting topic, just because I'm conscious that we've got a lot to get into in terms of retention. Very interesting. Might have to come back to that at a later stage. The one last thing that you did want to talk about, I think, briefly from the week, Dave, was in respect of using live data sets in test environments. Is that right?
For sure. It's something that's come up, and it's quite a valid argument. You could certainly argue that there's certainly a strong legitimate interest for making sure that your systems are secure, these systems are doing as they should be doing, and in order to ensure they're operating as intended, that you've got to put it through some form of beta testing, and what's better than putting live data through a test environment with appropriate safeguards and control measures around it. So, for example, if you're testing in an environment where you sent out a trigger notification to an individual, some of the safeguards may well be to remove the email addresses, or at least replace the email address or the text number with something that's associated with the organisation. So if there was a trigger notification went out, it was only sent to the organisation itself and not to the individual, or possibly switching off the trigger completely. But then the argument would be, well, how do you know the trigger bit's working? So you've got issues around that, but you certainly could say there's a kind of a strong legitimate interest in doing that. The issue that I came across, though, was whether you could legitimise or at least find an appropriate lawful basis under Article 9 for
using special category data in a test environment, because it's still a processing activity, still doing something with somebody's data, and what measures you might consider or what safeguards you might have to consider in order to use special category or special categories of personal data in a test environment, or whether the only option you've got is to create Mickey Mouse accounts.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. And I mean, in the context of that, we ended up sort of kicking around, didn't we, the idea of sort of using de-identified or depersonalized data sets from live environments into a test environment, which again, sort of the value behind that and whether it's even useful or practical. But then that sort of led us quite nicely onto today's topic, which is retention. And the reason there's a bit of a link there is that actually one of the first things we were going to look at was the change in definition around the requirement for retention. So as we know, under the 98 Data Protection Act, it was basically just that you can't keep personal data for any longer than it's necessary to meet your purposes. And that has changed slightly, hasn't it, under the GDPR. Now we talk about not being able to retain personal data for any longer than is necessary in an identifiable form. Essentially, is that right, Dave?
For sure, yeah. The wording's changed. Like I said, we used to be able to say it's retention, and I still hear conversations about where we need to sort out retention, which is right, but it's the technical element of it's not retention in much, storage limitation, isn't it? Isn't it? It's defined in the GDPR in brackets, a storage limitation that you can't keep personal information in an identifiable format for longer than is necessary, or that permits identification for longer than is necessary, which you're right, then kind of brings up connotations of, well, when we're talking about permitting identification, you could go down the line and say, well, we anonymize things. So if we anonymize things, will that be sufficient? So then how would we do anonymization in this sense? If you're looking at a housing management system or a CRM system that may have associated forms or associated documents to it, would the system necessarily permit full anonymization, and how would it do that if identification, as you know, when we talk about the definition of personal data, identification doesn't solely relate or rely on somebody's name being provided?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my next question sort of naturally in response to that, and it's something that I've been thinking about recently because I've been working on some retention projects with clients, is practically speaking, how do we go about that? How do we go about keeping a data set in a way which no longer permits identification? What does that look like? And more broadly, why would you want necessarily to keep a data set which is beyond reattribution? What might be the driving force behind that? I don't necessarily have the answers as of yet. I know that maybe for statistical purposes, I can understand that. But it's definitely sort of one of the questions I would pose is sort of why do you want this in the first place, really?
Well, from my point, if you're looking at retention, ultimately, this may seem rather kind of blunt, and I do apologise for that, but data's either got a value or it hasn't got a value. If the data hasn't got a value and you're storing it just because you can, regardless of whether it's identifiable or not, that's got a cost to it. So is it really value for money holding onto swathes of data that you're not planning on doing anything with in that sense? So you've got to kind of have an idea of what we're collecting stuff, what we're collecting it for, and what's the purpose. And ultimately, once it's got to its end of its life, it becomes nothing more than a cost center to maintain, to hold securely. System and softwares will eventually update. I've certainly worked with a client that's held on to an old CRM system for many years, and in order to extract information off it, they've got to switch the thing on, extract it, then switch the thing straight off quite quickly afterwards, because the thing's no longer maintained. It's got no patch updates. It's no longer have any other protections around it. So that then becomes a risk. So it becomes more of a liability than an asset in that sense. So before you even start thinking about anonymization, you kind of get into the point of, well, why are we collecting it? And trying to really understand, kind of starting point for me would be defining what is necessary in that sense. So so do we know what we're collecting? Do we know why we need to retain it? Do we know the purposes and what might impact are the reasons why we're maintaining it, for example? So it could be a legal or regulatory requirement to retain that information. But it's actually getting to that level of knowledge and understanding that. But then once you get to the end of the retention cycle, then the considerations then comes back to, well, this identifiable part.
So it's got to the end of the point that we want to retain it, and therefore, what's our action at the end of its that retention period?
Yeah, for sure. Leslie makes a very good point. It's one that I was sort of kicked around when I was thinking about this topic, is that you talk about, even if we don't necessarily deem that we need to keep a particular information asset or a particular data set, it's a question of whether our systems are actually able to implement and enforce retention criteria, which is a very, very astute observation. You know, it's entirely feasible to draw up a retention schedule and say, right, well, we're going to keep this for this long, we're going to keep this for that long, etc. But how do you actually go about implementing that? How do you go and do it? What if your systems, as Leslie's saying, don't have the capacity to, you know, actually enforce that properly?
Leslie, would you like to come in? I've just seen that you've just raised your hand.
Yeah, it was just picking up on what we're discussing here, really, because we're just currently going through this issue with our housing management system, where they kindly provided us with a GDPR module, as they called it. But when we looked at the GDPR module, and I'm not bothered about deletion, it was obfuscation, which is fine, X's, but it was only obfuscating what they deemed were personal data fields. And my point to them was, yeah, but there's links off to many other things here, that even if I click a link here, that takes me to something else, which deems that I could tell straight away then, because there's other data somewhere else that tells me who this person is. And their response was, oh, well, we should be able to do this. We can do this, but it will be an additional cost. So the first bit, which was, this is free if you want to, you know, obfuscate these 8 fields that we deem are, but if you want to do this, oh, no, that's the way that you've used the system, and therefore there's an extra cost to do that. So even though our retention quite clearly says this, actually working with the provider to actually ensure that it's done is fine. And it's what you went back to, is there is no value to keeping this record that we need for. We've done it for the 6 years. It needs to go now, and we don't need to keep it. But it was interesting, their version of what GDPR meant and what my version of GDPR meant was two entirely different things.
For sure. And it's a really good point that you raised there, Leslie, because I've certainly come across it myself. With many of the bits that you touched on, one software provider saying we have got something that is compliant in their eyes, but in order to have access to that, you've got to pay for an upgrade. Mm. And you're kind of thinking, well, I'm a bit shocked that I've now got to pay for a system that should be compliant with the law. I've now got to pay extra to make sure that it is compliant with the law.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
It doesn't feel right, does it?
No, you're not helping me to be compliant with the law. You know, you're just not assisting me with this at all. So,
But the other point, and I think it touches on what Ollie was leading here, and it's a very valid point as well, is, well, if we're anonymising, it's okay saying, well, we can either anonymise it, or we can put X's in bits and pieces to kind of to take that detail away where you can. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those 8 fields in the example that you provided were the only 8 fields that identifiable data sits.
Yeah.
So then how do you make sure that in that sense it's consistent across the records and across how you're using the system?
Yeah. And I agree with some of the others. It's not just the system that we're using. It's across many suppliers. We've got it with other suppliers as well. So,
but it, for it's, sure. For
it's still sure. Still difficult for us to comply with this, with the retention principle, whatever we want to call it now, the support of the system suppliers.
Yeah, no, for sure. I often find myself kicking myself, quite frankly. If I went into software development instead of understanding the GDPR, I might have a compliant software system, and I might be challenging Bill Gates for the parking rights at Monaco, but I haven't. I went the other way, unfortunately. But you're in this kind of between a rock and a hard place at times with what can the system manage and how can it do it? Because you can't necessarily sit there with a team of people manually doing the deletion when you've got a lot of records sense, firstly. And then secondly, so you are looking for some kind of solution through the IT provider that you're using with whatever system that you've got. And sometimes their offerings aren't that great either, so you're kind of between this rock and a hard place. Yeah. And to be fair, and to, in complete justification, it's not, if anybody's actually been through a move between CRM systems, it is not the first point of call I'd be looking at, because it's awfully painful to go from one database setup to a different database setup with a completely different provider. It's a horrendous move to go through. I've done it previously, and it's a horrendous move to go through. So you are in this kind of, well, it feels like all avenues have stopped. We can't afford teams of people to delete this stuff. We're looking for a system. We can't afford the downtime to move, because it's a good 6 to 9 months transiting between two different databases by the time you've gone through everything. We haven't got that kind of time to kind of address this point at this moment in time. So we're looking to the software providers for assistance. And it's in some cases, you're kind of left wanting.
Yeah.
Sure. I just wanted to pick up very quickly on the point that Beverly's making in the chat, because this is a very astute point. One which I was sort of ramping up to in a way, is that one of the key issues, I think, in all of this is, as you quite rightly say, Beverly, the individual understanding as to, what we're actually doing here, and then bridging any potential gaps between that understanding and the requirements of the law. And it's one of the first things I come in that, you start a retention task and there's not necessarily even an awareness of the personal data that we have, why we have it, or what the life cycle associated with it should be. And that really surely has to be the first step in all of this, doesn't it, Dave? Really, is having a good grasp on what you have in the first place and why you have it, because that's going to determine fundamentally how long you're going to keep it, surely.
It's for sure. You've got to understand what you're collecting and why you're collecting it. And it's unfortunate. I don't think a lot of people's been through that process under the 1998 Act, let alone under the current process. So sometimes you find kind of little battles against, and not just in kind of mapping your data flows and documenting why you're doing stuff, but it's kind of just challenging thought processes. So it's why are we doing this? Why do we collect that? And it's sometimes you get the feeling in it kind of at a summary, it's because it's what we've always done. And nobody's actually ever kind of sat down and go, but why do we need this bit here? What value is that adding? In that sense, we've got this field, I don't know, so for example, and it's only a complete random example. For example, you've got a date of birth field within a garage application of a housing management system, or within a housing association. But what's this field add? Is this field actually necessary in this sense? And I don't think people's actually ever really taken it to that kind of point. And it comes back to what you were saying there earlier about actually understanding, well, what are we doing and why are we doing it and what do we need? And trying to apply the minimization principle there within the GDPR as only kind of collecting, creating process in the minimal amount of data. And I think sometimes these things have through function creep or through just not putting things to scrutiny, that we've kind of got ourselves in a position where we are collecting stuff, we are kind of saving stuff, but why? Well, I'm really not sure. And you kind of then say, well, what laws govern how long you can retain stuff for? And you kind of go, well, we can retain it, surely for the life of the tenancy, that kind of thing. And you kind of get very vague answers back when you just try stress testing some of the knowledge.
Yeah, there's a couple of things tied into that. And I've spotted Tony's point in the chat, and I really do want to come back to that because it's an excellent point. But just to pick up on what you were saying there, I think really that the first port of call, so we talk about awareness, but also really is being proactive on these things. And first of all, is implementing minimization policies and procedures going forwards, because fundamentally you don't have to worry about retaining data if you don't have it. So just making sure that in the first place you're actually collecting the absolute minimum and not creating an asset which becomes unmanageable in future, I think is probably a very important thing to think about. And then there's a question which is I always sort of ask myself on these sorts of things, which is, where do you actually stand? So if you're starting a retention project from scratch, it's never been thought about before in the organization, do you focus in the first instance on getting in place the policies, the procedures, the framework effectively to ensure that compliant retention is applied going forward? So talking about things like implementing good minimization strategies from the get-go, or do you focus on effectively stopping the rot and going back and looking at, right now, okay, well, we have to deal with these right this second, and we'll effectively worry about future retention periods and assets that we're going to have to manage at a later stage. Where do you start with that? I'm not entirely sure, to be honest, Dave, in terms of where you would start with that.
From my starting point, I think the and I'm more than happy to be challenged on it. I think from my starting point, you would be looking at understanding what we've got. It is all right trying to understand how long we should keep it for and having policies and procedures and governance measures and bits and pieces in place. But all that kind of really hinges on, well, what have you got? We don't know when to delete it unless we know what we've got. We don't know how to keep it secure unless we know what we've got and we know where it's going and we know how it's moving through the organisation and who's having access to it. So we can't put any of those measures around it until we actually understand what we've got. So the starting point for me would be possibly the kind of the data mapping exercise, making sure that the if you've got a rope or if you're really starting from scratch to actually kind of build your records of processing activities and actually have a considered look at, well, what are we doing now, regardless of whether even minimisation taking place, what are we doing now? And once you've detailed that and you understand what you're doing, then you can start challenging things about minimization and then going through the measures around what you've mentioned. I think that for me would be the natural starting point. But where are we? Kind of a snapshot in time. Let's have a look at where we are now, regardless of where we should be. Where are we now and where do we take it?
I think that's very astute. There's another point I wanted to pick up on that you mentioned a second ago, you touched on briefly, which was sort of challenging the knowledge around how long we have to keep things. And this is something that comes back to me quite regularly, is that sometimes, particularly in the support desk function that we have, we'll sometimes be asked to review a retention schedule and say, well, what do you think to this? And fundamentally, we can have a look at it, we can assess the structure, we can assess whether we think retention periods seem more or less proportionate and appropriate. But fundamentally, for some of these things, really, you need a subject matter expert to tell you. I mean, you know, I can tell you what the GDPR says, but I don't necessarily know what the rules and regulations are around HR, for instance. You know, I can, sure, I can have an awareness of some of the broader, you know, statutes and some of the broader regulations or guidelines which will govern a lot of these retention periods that we put in place. So, you know, 6 years in relation to the Limitations Act and bring in an action for breach of contract. You know, that's one of the ones that I've got saved. But really, if I'm asked to look at a retention schedule, break it down and say, well, that's not appropriate, that is, I don't really necessarily have the grounding to be able to do that. So there's a question there around, well, is it the DPO's responsibility to be across all of this? I can't imagine it is, because I think that's potentially disproportionate, although I'm happy to be challenged on that. So how do you go about doing it? I mean, my innate reaction is to say, well, you know, if there's an asset owner there and they're fundamentally responsible for that asset or that process, it's their responsibility to go away and think about how long they need it for and justify it and be able to point to where in the law it says they're allowed to keep it for this long or they need to keep it this long, rather.
Yeah, I think you hit a bit of a valid point, because if you don't know it exists, then where do you know to go looking for it? So you will need some kind of subject matter expert, whether that's in HR and HR experts through the training that HR departments have had, for example, and maybe looking at people who's provides kind of regular training or CPD hours and things for purely for the HR. That's with that being in the function, because you do. And I know sometimes it's pretty difficult. But you said to somebody, well, how long are you keeping this information? I say, well, we're keeping it for 6 years because we can. And you say, well, where does that lie? And then it starts getting a bit shady. And so sometimes the detail is missing. And although you can say, if it's an employment contract, for example, you can you can force the contract, as you mentioned, because of the Limitations Act 1980. I think Schedule 2, Section 2, I think it is, or 3. So it's within there that says that they've got this measure. So therefore, we'll keep information on a contract for that purpose. But sometimes that in itself leads to queries where people kind of saying, and I've seen it, should I say, where you're kind of going, well, let's have a look at continuing on the HR example. So Ollie, you're employed with us, so we'll keep everything to your employment for the purposes of 6 years, because it's because we can, without necessarily being mindful of the guidance, where the 6 years bit is really for the direct effect of the contract. Anything that is ancillary but associated is not necessarily caught by the 6 year period. And that could be the same for housing associations with tenants, where the tenancy agreement and for the direct performance of the agreement in that sense is caught. And I think it was direction for the European Data Protection Board gave guidance on
what contractual means in that sense, and all the ancillary stuff, isn't it? So this then leads you to kind of think, I'm just going to give you a quick example on that. And it's purely an example. If you were a housing association, you had a tenant staying with you that had one episode of antisocial behaviour, possibly, as you've ascertained, it was through association with drink or drugs, but that might be linked to a serious death in the family, say of a loss of parent, and had a little bit of a troubled period of time going through bereavement and things, but since kind of reformed themselves, got help, and is no longer in that behaviour, you can't argue that the ability to hold one episode of antisocial behaviour for life of the tenancy would work. Because if that tenant was a tenant with you for 20 years, for example, then arguably you're holding that information for 26 years. You've still got the ability to go, well, actually, that was then, it's not now. It's not directly tied to the performance of the contract per se. And therefore, saying that you want to keep it for life of a tenancy plus 6 years is excessive. And this is where some of the detail in my eyes kind of falls down with, and again, comes back to retention period, because it's not a blanket, well, I'll keep everything for 6 years then. You've got to work out which bits are caught by 6 years and which bits then have other implications, either longer or shorter.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely spot on. And there's a number of people raising some points about some very good resources in the chat, which obviously sector dependent are going to be a port of call. You're all absolutely right on those, particularly around things like, as you quite rightly say, RIC tax and things like that, which have very specific requirements associated with them. Someone's just mentioned the NHF, National Housing Federation guidelines, which absolutely a very good resource around that. I'm just keeping an eye on the chat because there are a couple of things I do want to come back to on what you've just said, Dave. But Steph, I'm not entirely sure I understand your earlier comment in relation to event sourcing. You're more than welcome to come on and discuss it, but I'll be completely honest, I'm not sure I entirely understand what you mean there. So you're more than welcome to. You were talking, Dave, about sort of issues with blanket approaches. And just because I'm really keen to not move past it, I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about Tony's point, where he asks, what are the implications of deleting data earlier than the legal or regulatory periods? Which is very interesting, because we've come across this before, where particularly in housing, where, you know, a record has been deleted for whatever reason, because it's been decided that it's come to the end of its useful life cycle, and then all of a sudden a tenant wants access to it. You say, well, actually, we've gotten rid of it. And that poses a sort of very interesting question. I think fundamentally, and I'm happy for anyone to jump in on this and offer their thoughts. I'm always looking to crowdsource opinions on these sessions. But obviously, you've got the requirement to make sure that the data is not just only stored for an appropriate period of time, but also that data is fundamentally adequate. And if you start deleting data sets sort of before you should, then arguably you've got issues around the adequacy of your data. That's really what I thought the main issue would be on that. I don't know if you've got any reactions to that, Dave.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of points, really. I think it still comes back to understanding what you're returning it for. If you're returning it for a legal obligation and you delete it early, then in effect that you're not complying with legal obligation. The information is then not available when it should be available, and therefore you've got a straight accessibility breach. Information is not made available when it's required to those who maybe need access to it. In addition to that, if you then just answer, for example, there's no legal reason for holding it, there's no regulatory guidance or requirements for you to hold it through whichever regulator that you're caught by, so then you kind of straight organisational choice as to how long you're retaining it for, justifiable choice, not just any choice, but a justifiable choice where you're holding it. It then still comes back to, if you're publishing within your privacy policy periods or providing mechanisms to justify the periods, and you say, well, actually, we're holding this information for 3 years, and you still delete it early, then arguably, are you not breaching the fair, lawful and transparent principle? Because you're telling people that they should be able to have access to this for a period of time, you've deleted it early, so is that then still not a straight accessibility breach? Because you've got rid of it early. by all means, if your retention periods have passed, you've got a justifiable stance then to say, look, we told you only can keep it for 3 years. It's now 3 years and 3 months. It's been deleted in line with our retention schedule. It's justifiable, but it's this early element and whether we're telling people fairly, whether we understand how long we're keeping it for in that mix. And I think if you're not careful, you could be falling foul of being fair, lawful and transparent, or at least the fairness element of it, if there's anybody want to argue the other two elements. But certainly it's not fair to tell people we'll keep it for a period of time and then to delete it early.
That's, yeah, extremely astute, actually, which I hadn't considered, quite frankly. I'd tell you what, just quickly in relation to that, and we also mentioned before sort of opaque privacy information, do you know what still drives me up the wall is privacy notices or privacy policies, which still stick to the, we'll only hold your data for as long as we need it, and after that we'll get rid of it, despite the fact that European Data Protection Board guidelines say that is not sufficient. You have to tell people, you have to be more specific about what your retention period is. It's not good enough to just say we'll only hold it for as long as we need it. It's too vague. It drives me absolutely mad when I see it.
Another quick one back to you then, Olin. It's only a very moot point on what you've raised there. So if you've produced a retention schedule, should that be a public-facing document?
Yeah, that's very interesting, actually. I suppose, well, obviously, if you're a Freedom of Information Act public body, that's going to be caught, isn't it? So that's sort of rules them out de facto. But, I mean, I'll be honest, my gut instinct is, well, yes, it should be. You know, why shouldn't it be? I don't really see any reason to obscure that. I don't know. I'm happy to be challenged on that. Rick and Ali seem to agree with me on that, but yeah, I'm happy to be challenged. I don't see why that should be something which is obscured. I think it probably should be a public document.
Well, absolutely. I think it comes back to being fair, lawful and transparent. I think it should be a public facing document. I think you should be open and transparent about what we are doing with information and why, in order to give effect to it. So I personally think it should be, but like I said, it's just personal question to see what people's thoughts are.
No, you do right, you do right. Yeah, Special does make a very good point. She says, not sure she agrees on the privacy notice. If you have many proxy services, it's impossible to put this in a notice without making this too long, which is another criticism. Yeah, that is very true. That is very true. There's certainly a balance to be struck, because you're quite right. If you get into the habit of, you know, making sort of 15-page privacy notices, well, they're not really transparent either, are they? Because all of a sudden, then you're making it inaccessible. So, no, you're absolutely right.
I personally think it comes down to a couple of things. One, you need to be succinct, but using clear, plain language so people understand what you're talking about. And if you've got complicated setups, then find different ways to display the message. We've certainly got some clients that have drop-down sections. So if you're looking at the privacy notice, an individual can self-drive themselves with a bit of interest because you just click on the drop-down section that they're interested in, as opposed to necessarily trawling through a full 15 pages. I've certainly seen some that are demonstrated in a really, really good way. I'm just trying to think which client it is that we've got them, but I've certainly seen them. I'll have a little look around when you do some chats next, Ollie. But where you literally have the privacy policy on the website as a series of drop-down sections. So you can kind of go, well, I'm not interested in this bit. I just want to know how long you keep it for. I just want to know what my rights are. And you still direct yourself to those bits without necessarily downloading the 15-page document.
Yeah, absolutely. A number of people talk about layered approaches and potentially including a hyperlink to the retention schedule, as Rick says, or as David suggests, breaking down privacy notices. So yeah, that's an approach that we very much favour, is you know, making sure they're tailored so that they can be specific to the individual, whether that's, you know, staff or customers, or even between different customers, if you have substantially different processing activities between different types of customer. In theory, particularly in housing, you know, if you have different types of tenants, you might need different types of privacy notice. So it's there's certainly a balance to be struck. I tell you, I've got some notes here up for the session, Dave, and there's one thing I did want to pick up, because Phil prepared these in advance. I don't know if he's going to be able to join us in the end, because I think he would have done by now if he were able to. But he's highlighted here a challenge, which is a challenge in terms of retention, which is structured versus unstructured data. And when I read that, the first thing that came to me, because I was confronted with this some time ago, was obviously where you are a Freedom of Information Act public authority, it's not good enough to just say, well, it's unstructured data, because obviously that's still core under the Freedom of Information Act. However, for a private sector body, is it potentially sufficient to say, well, actually, this warehouse of documents we've got here doesn't pass the temp test? By which I mean that if you asked a temp to go and look for something and they couldn't find it, therefore it's probably unstructured data and therefore it's not caught by the GDPR. Is that good enough? It's a question for the room. Again, I don't necessarily have the answers. Joe, any thoughts on that, Dave?
I was just trying to get think through the samples. So you're saying from a retention point, would you need to document retention around unstructured data?
Well, yeah, and my point being that obviously if it's not part of a filing system or intended to form part of a filing system, in theory at least, it's exempt from the GDPR. So you've not got a requirement around that. So is it good enough to just say, well, we'll leave that for the time being, or we might leave it for indefinitely? Is that too easy? Is that a bit of a cop-out?
Quite an interesting concept. So if what you're saying is if it's not intended or produced for the purposes or intention of being processed in an automated manner or partly automated manner, and it's not part of a structured filing system or intended to be part of a structured filing system, in essence, you're saying if it falls outside of scope two of the GDPR, so it's then not caught by the GDPR, does retention apply?
Yeah.
I would have possibly said if you're not caught by the GDPR, then why putting kind of fences around it as if it were caught by the GDPR?
That's a very good point. It's a very good point. It only came up because one of my clients, sort of as we were working through a retention project, sort of said, oh, by the way, please don't panic, but we have got effectively a warehouse full of documents that have been there since the 80s and we don't really know what's in there. Which is, you know, prefacing that with don't panic isn't necessarily helpful. So that was sort of something that we kicked around. Tony, I'm more than happy for you to come on, please do, to discuss that issue, because it's one which I have been confronted with before, and it is quite interesting.
Okay, more than happy to do that. I'm Tony, sadly a loving data protection officer. Right, I'll tell you what it actually was. We migrated from a housing application or a database from one system to a new system. And so we migrated across all the data. And it was brought to my attention that the service didn't take across all the complete legacy data. So our retention schedule said we had to hold the data for 6 years. And the old database had to be decommissioned for security reasons because we couldn't support it. So if we left the database on our network, it would have what we call our PSN implications, our security compliance. And so we had to make the decision, either we hold the application, which is unsupported, or, you know, in case we need to refer back to it, or basically, you know, terminate the application. So we took the decision to actually terminate the application, which meant we only took across 2 to 3 years legacy data. Now that's going to have an implication on if we get a subject access request. So I did speak to the ICO about it, and they said, well, the two things you've got to do is update your retention schedules to reflect the new retention periods. But also, if you do have a subject access request, you need to inform the data subject how long, you know, why didn't you hold it for the six-year period. So that's one of the areas, that's what, sort of an example where we had to make the decision to delete it early.
No, that's interesting. Thanks for that. It's also interesting to hear that that's the ICO's response to it, very pragmatic by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I'm just going to follow that up with that, Tony. I've certainly had a client that's had something similar, but they took the old legacy offline. They had the very similar issues with being able to maintain it and it being a security risk and bits and pieces. So they, in essence, put it out of reach from a cyber point and a technical point. And if they needed to go into it, then it was under control measures because it posed a risk, and they ran with that for a period of time until they felt it wasn't going to infringe any of the retention periods, and then they decommissioned it fully. But that still had a management element to knowing that the database was there, knowing that had information on it, and control and access measures if you had to go back into it and you sought to do that. The only concern I would have would be if there's any remaining information on the database that you maybe want to seek to rely on, should there be any form of litigation, that you've also then lost that kind of focus. But following what Ollie said, it seemed a rather pragmatic approach from the ICO, just to kind of, well, update your privacy policy to reflect shortened periods for the time being.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. I'm aware that we've only got about 5 minutes left. As ever, Dave, we sort of panic before these sessions, say, oh my God, what are we going to talk about? And then, you know, it gets to 5 minutes before 1:30, and we've somehow managed to fill the hour. Partly a lot of the time because of the excellent interactions that we get from the chat and those coming on. So the final 5 minutes, Dave, in terms of best practice, in terms of top tips for retention, what's the approach? What's the key thing to bear in mind in all of this?
Well, that's a good question. The key thing to bear in mind is it can be a bit of a thorny issue, as we discussed. You can find yourself between a rock and a hard place. As Tony's alluded to, you may be in the process of decommissioning software and so on and so forth. So it can have a thorny issue. It can have implications, and it's trying to work through what those are in a structured way. It won't be it could be an issue that a lot of organizations could end up facing, because I certainly know many of my clients are moving to SharePoint setups, so they're looking at, can we clean there's really no point in copying over rubbish, so we need to work out what we've got and why we've got it and what we've got and how we got it and how long we need it for, and is it still relevant, because we don't want to put rubbish into SharePoint. We want to put kind of a clean set of information over into SharePoint and for the retention periods to be managed in that sense. But it is a thorny issue. You've got to try and understand it, and it, to me, I think the takeaway for it is really understanding what you've got and why you've got it and what are the implications of that.
Yeah, I'd completely agree. I think in addition to that, you know, really in terms of knowing what you have, why you have it, what it's used for, just to come back on what we said earlier, which I think to me is really one of the key aspects to this, which is really active and strong minimization mechanisms in place from the start, because obviously that just helps manage things down the line. Then supplementing that obviously with your actual retention schedule, which to my mind, as we said before, rely on the subject matter experts essentially within the business, or, you know, as we as a number of people have very helpfully put in the chat, some of the resources that are out there and available for certain sectors in particular. And then obviously you have to have the technical controls to actually enforce that, because the last thing I would want to do is entrust people to actually comply with retention periods themselves. I mean, seeing what that leads to, I can say that that's not the approach to take.
I guess just kind of loosely talking around it, the reason why I say you've got to understand, I know you've been through it as well, Ollie, when you kind of work with clients on kind of data mapping and things, it's once you start to understand what you've got, you then start to open your eyes as to, well, organisationally, what you've got, what you didn't actually know existed, because people are doing all sorts of different bits and pieces. People create reports and download them and keep them places that you might not be aware of, and it's all the unknowns start coming through in that sense. So I think for me, I think it still comes back to really understanding what you've got and what are people doing and where are they saving it and should they be saving it and so on and so forth, because there's every time I go through a data mapping exercise, we always find more than what the client actually expected to exist.
Yeah, spot on. Steph mentions that he says he used to work in insurance, and each year they did something called evaluation, i.e. evaluating their liability and ensuring they had the assets to cover it, and whether sort of that approach would effectively make sense in this context, and I think it absolutely would. It makes perfect sense. I'll tell you what, we're very close to the end. There's just one thing, and it's just come to me, and I wish I'd brought it up earlier because it's an interesting topic, but it's where we stand on the issue of being a processor and trying to suggest appropriate retention periods to your clients or our controllers, because this is something I've come across a couple of times recently where, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about what an appropriate retention period is for the data that we're processing on behalf of someone else, but sort of trying to gently suggest to a controller that this is what's appropriate, and they sort of go, no, it's fine, keep it for either much longer or much shorter period of time. It's a shame I didn't think of it earlier, to be honest, because it's an interesting one to kick around. But nonetheless, yeah, we're basically out of time. As ever, we've managed to rabbit on for the full hour. So thank you, Dave, for all of your input and insights on all of that. As Rob quite rightly says, thank you everyone in the chat and on the session. Absolutely wonderful interactions today. It's always excellent. Also, a special thank you to our partners in bringing you this session, Reed. I think, Brian, if you want to come on and say a couple of words in that respect, please do. But a huge thank you to them on that front.
Yeah, and, we'd certainly like to thank Reed. We're doing a lot of work with them in regards to data privacy and getting the message out there across multiple industries. So if anyone is looking for, obviously, recruitment, get in touch with me for DPOs. But thank you again.
Yes, thank you, Brian. And yeah, thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back next week with another session, GDPR Radio, I believe, this time. So that's just an open session for us to kick some ideas around. But in the meantime, as Rick says, enjoy the sunshine, and we hope to see you all very soon.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Great session again, Ollie, there. And thank you to those who took part.
Yes. Thanks all. Take care now.
Bye-bye.